This is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks on KQV with expert advice from CPA attorney and retirement and estate planning expert Jim Lang, the best-selling author of Retire Secure and the Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. Now on the air and online worldwide at RetireSecure.com. Get ready to talk smart money.
Hello and welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. I'm your host, Nevin Harris, and of course I'm here with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, and best-selling author of the first and second edition of Retire Secure, and now his new book, The Roth Revolution, Pay Taxes Once and Never Again. Jim is the president of a CPA firm and prepares tax returns, a law firm that drafts wills and trusts, and a registered investment advisory firm that provides cutting-edge retirement and estate planning strategies. Tonight, Jim is joined by Julie Jason. Julie is a great champion of the consumer in the financial services world. When AARP, that is, the American Association of Retired People, wanted to publish a book about making decisions regarding retirement, they tapped one of the great consumer advocates, Julie Jason. Her fifth book, The AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad, has received several awards and was named one of the top 10 business books of 2010 by Booklist. With both Jim Lang and Julie Jason, two world-class retirement experts, you are sure to enjoy a lively and informative conversation. It is a pleasure to have you on the show, Julie.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and that was quite an introduction.
Well, you're very welcome. But before I turn it over to Jim, I want to remind our listeners that the show is live, so please feel free to call in. The number is 412-333-9385. Again, 412-333-9385. Good evening, Jim.
And hi, Julie. I actually added that part about the champion of the consumer. As I was reading your book and then talking with you in preparation for the show, I thought, wow, here's a woman who's really trying to help people. And I really mean that. So my hat is off to you both in your practice and your books. I genuinely got the feeling that you have nothing but the best intention for people. And that is also the type of people that is the type of author that AARP looks for. Anyway, when we spoke, you said that one of the things that you were very interested in, particularly these days, and it's actually something that we have addressed on the show, and I'm also very interested to get your take on it, is the issue of the safe withdrawal rate, or how much money retirees can spend in retirement. So I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what some of your thoughts on the safe withdrawal rate and how they can determine how much money they can safely afford to spend given the resources that they have.
Yeah, you know, if you think about it, that's really the most important question that you can answer if you're approaching retirement or in retirement. And the problem that I keep coming in contact with is people who think that there's some sort of magic number that is the answer. And you see either a 3% or 4% or 5% or even, you know, when I was writing the AARP book, just a couple, it came out in 2009, at that point, financial advisors were actually saying, some were actually saying that you could actually take out 8 or 9 or 10 or even 11% safely out of your portfolio. And, of course, there is no magic number, and the reason why there isn't is because it all depends on how much you need to live on and how you invest and how long of a horizon that you have ahead of you. So it is a completely personal sort of exercise, and there one number will be appropriate for one person and another number will be an appropriate number for another person, and it may change as markets change and also as inflation changes. So there's no quick answer to this.
But that's what our listeners want to hear. They want to hear the quick, easy answer. but let's try to look at this a little bit more specifically. One of the things that you said that was very interesting and something that I agree with, and I think Bill Bengen, who did some of the original research in this area would talk about is actually the length of time that you need the money. So let's say for discussion's sake, and I know that you don't like a one number answer, but I think at least traditionally 4% of your active of your portfolio was deemed the safe withdrawal rate. In other words, if let's say to make it a nice easy number that you have a $1 million portfolio and you could safely withdraw 4%, or you could in effect take out $40,000 a year and within a reasonable probability never run out of money. Well, and that might be a starting point. You might argue that it should be smaller than that, but I think both you and I would agree that that number might be even too high, or at least you certainly don't want to go over that if you are 60 years old and you're very healthy and your parents live to be 100. On the other hand, if you're 95 years old and you just went to the doctor and the doctor said, oh, geez, I'm sorry, that spot on your lung is inoperable, then obviously you can afford to spend a lot more than 4%.
Yeah, time horizon is one of the elements that needs to be looked at. So, you know, how long, no one knows how long they're going to live, obviously, but a 60-year-old should plan, the plan should be at least 30 years, 30 to 40 years. So you're right. In terms of the longer the horizon, the lower the rate should be. But as a devil's advocate, let me ask you, Jim, if all your money is in CDs, would you say that a 4% withdrawal rate is the right number?
Well, what I would say, of course, what Bill Bengen would say is he has actually, in effect, recommended portfolios for different safe withdrawal rates.
Right. So it really depends on how you are invested and how you think of risk as to what that safe withdrawal rate might be. And, of course, time horizon. But when you really get down to when you sit down with a client and you take a look at their cash flows and you take a look at their how they've been investing, you can draw some conclusions as to what might make sense for the future. But it really is investment dependent and market dependent and, of course, cash flow dependent.
Well, I would agree with all that. At the risk of oversimplifying, though, what I would like to do, and then you can certainly make a counter argument, is to give people, say, some guidelines rather than just say, "Oh, gee, it depends on your situation." So, if you like, I will talk about, let's say, some of the guidelines that I see both in the Financial Planning Association and Bill Bengen, and maybe you could respond saying if you think that is appropriate. And by the way, if I am a listener, this is, I think, very important information. So, and these might be a little bit higher in terms of safe withdrawal rates than you might be comfortable with, Julie, but I'd be very interested in your reaction. So he would say, for a 45-year time horizon with a 65% equity allocation and a 35% fixed income allocation, that 4.1% would be the appropriate safe withdrawal rate. And then let's say a 25-year timeline, it would be a 4.7% safe withdrawal rate with a 45% equity allocation. And for a 10-year time horizon, so you're really talking about people in their perhaps late 70s or even 80s, that the maximum safe withdrawal rate would be 8.9%, and that would be with a 40% stock and a 60% bond allocation.
So the intention there is to go down to zero, to have a terminal value of zero at the end of that period. Is that right?
Well, I think that he would say that that's not necessarily the goal, because none of my clients have successfully spent their last dollar and died, mainly because they're too prudent, so they would not do that. But mm-hmm. that is the number that presumably they can spend without the intention of leaving money to the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I as a money manager, I would argue with every single one of those.
I figured you would.
Yeah, I would. I mean, take someone. Let's go back in history for a little bit. In 1999, at the end of we're in the middle of the internet bubble market, and so in January of 2000, I actually had a couple come in to the office, and they wanted to take all of their. They were referred by a very good client of mine, so I had to be really, really nice to them. But they wanted to go 100% into the technology market, and they had a really well-invested portfolio that was a good collection of classic high-dividend-paying stocks, well-managed companies, and bonds. And their allocation probably was about a 60-40 allocation. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to move 100% into technology because they felt left out. So, I told them that I would not be able to do that for them, that they would have to do that somewhere else.
Good for you.
Right. And they were very upset, I have to say. But so it was a very difficult thing for me to do. But, you see, so I say, well, what's the market doing? If they had moved 100% to technology stocks, or let's say they moved 60% to technology stocks, they would have lost 85% of that technology position. So would they be, and let's say they were in their 80s, would they have been able to withdraw 8.9% of the portfolio? No. The portfolio would have gone to zero.
Well, sure. So, and of course, I am making assumptions about a well-diversified portfolio that I perhaps didn't speak to. I just, the reason why I like to give people some number. And I understand that it depends on what the portfolio and what's going on right now, is that I just didn't want to be mamby-pamby and not give anybody any guidance.
Right. See, if I were to come up with a number, I would be really looking at the down. See, here's another aspect of it. Now, someone who invests on their own, if they're applying these numbers and they're investing on their own and they really don't spend too much time doing any research, let's say they just look at Money Magazine and pull some hot stocks or hot mutual funds, and they're buying the funds because of past performance, they need a lower withdrawal rate because you need lots of experience in the market to really know how to withdraw a higher number. So I think it's also experience-based. Someone who is working with you would have your guidance. Someone working with me would have my guidance. So we can take on a little more risk than the average person. And I don't think there's enough said about that. You know, I think this is why it is so personal, because it deals with cash flows, but also deals with how does the individual address risk. And many people, left to their own devices, address risk in the wrong way. The Morningstar publishes data on investor returns, and so does Dalbar. If you look at investor returns, you'll see that people pull out of the market at the wrong time, and they put their money into the market right at the wrong time. So their actual returns are generally nowhere near the return of the actual, let's say it's a mutual fund. The returns are just lagging that mutual fund's return. So if you also give them the idea that they can pull out a high number, that just compounds the problem. So they're taking money out at the wrong time, putting money in at the wrong time, and then they're taking out a high number. So that's why it's so hard to give an exact number. But your suggestion at being at 4.5%, I would lower to 2% if they have no experience, maybe 3% if they have a little more experience, and perhaps 4% if they are experienced. If they're working with someone who has experience, such as you, for example, then that's a different matter altogether.
And I guess I was assuming a well-diversified portfolio, and to me, one of the reasons that you use a money manager is not necessarily because you're shooting for the moon, but because you are looking for a downside protection, and you're not going to get that by putting it all in CDs and fixed income, but by a very broadly well-diversified portfolio. And I think that is the underlying assumptions of some of the numbers that I gave. But it's still fine to, if anything, you want to err on the side of being conservative. That is not going over, and what you don't want to do is be 90 years old and broke.
Right, you don't want to move back in with your children.
All right, Julie and Jim, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I want to remind our listeners out there that we are live tonight. So if you have any thoughts and you want to chime in, you can give us a call at 412-333-9385. We'll be right back in a minute with Julie Jason, Jim Lang on the Lang Money Hour.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Hello there, and welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. This is Nevin Harris, and I'm here with Jim Lang and Julie Jason, author of the AARP Survival Guide.
I'm still looking for a little bit more retirement income for some of our clients, and you know, and I'm not talking about some of the products. One of the things that we have not taken into account in the calculation of safe withdrawal rates, and I am interested in your take on this, is let's assume for discussion's sake that somebody has a paid-up home. So if we go back to our initial example of having $1 million in investable assets, and I understand that you're a little bit uncomfortable with the 4.4% safe withdrawal rate that I used for a 25-year life expectancy, but let's even say that we knock it down to 4% if it's managed responsibly or even less. What can we do how can we adjust our thinking if there is a paid-up home, and let's assume for discussion's sake that the fair market value of the home is maybe $300,000?
Are you thinking in terms of a reverse mortgage?
Well, I was actually expecting you to bash a reverse mortgage.
Yeah, why would you expect that? Well, I think reverse mortgages are, you know, there's a lot of advertising that goes on television and the like. And the thing about reverse mortgages that you have to be careful of is that it really is a one-time, it really is a lifelong decision because they can be extremely expensive, and people going into a reverse mortgage only think in terms of the money coming out. And it is just one of these solutions that you want to just be very, very careful that you understand exactly what you're paying, what can happen if there's a default on the mortgage, and what do you have at the end of the process. So let's say you need to go into a nursing home. Let's say you're away from that home for more than a year. There's a possibility that the bank can take the home away from you, and if the cost of the reverse mortgage is very high, which can be, then there may be no value for your children. So it's just the sort of thing that you just really want to address very carefully before signing on. It's not one of these 10-minute type of decisions.
Well, I would agree with that, and I'm very leery. I love the concept of it. I like the idea that, in effect, you could spend more money in retirement and not leave all the equity of your home if that's not what you want to do. On the other hand, sometimes some of the costs and restrictions and the importance of that decision might lean you in other directions. I know that what Jonathan Clemens says, and I'll be interested to hear your take on this, is that he says when you are calculating the base for what you multiply the safe withdrawal rate, that you can actually take 60% of the fair market value of your home into account. So in other words, what he would do is he would say, okay, the fair market value of the equity, or in this case a paid up home, would be $300,000. 60% of that is $180,000. Then he would multiply that number times the 4% or 4.4% or whatever safe withdrawal rate you are using. And he would say that it is safe to spend that on the theory that at some point in your life, you could either get a reverse mortgage, a traditional mortgage, a home equity loan, or if absolutely necessary, to sell the home. But he would say that income-hungry retirees would not be limited purely to the safe withdrawal rate times their portfolio value. I don't know if you have ever used.
Yeah, I have not seen that argument, but I can tell you, you can probably tell I'm a little more conservative than a lot of folks.
Well, I can tell that, and that's one of the reasons why I say that you are the consumer advocate.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that none of your clients are broke when they're old.
Exactly. Rather than taking, personally, I would never do that, and I have to ask whether this theory came up during the housing bubble or whether it still applies today.
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the exact timing. I will tell you, though, that Jonathan Clemens and I did an article that did appear in the Wall Street Journal, and the gist of it was that you might do better with a home equity loan, even if the intention is to never repay the loan in full. Mm-hmm. To get additional money. So, and the other thing of course, these days it's getting harder to get a mortgage, but, and this might be another area where you might be more conservative than I am, but I would hate to see people have a terrible restriction on their lifestyle when they have a huge amount of equity in their home and the possibility of borrowing it against it, either with a traditional...
Traditional mortgage,
or a home equity loan would be a possibility to enhance their retirement.
Again, jumping in as just a devil's advocate, with a home equity loan, one would then take cash out of the home and then have typically a variable interest rate where they would owe money at a variable interest rate typically, right? Sometimes can be fixed, but...
Yeah, I actually would obviously prefer fixed, but
right.
but I would probably agree that more home equity loans are variable than fixed.
So the scenario would be, let's say somebody takes $100,000 out of the home. So now they use that money for lifestyle, or do they use that money for to invest?
No, I would never take money out and invest it. And I wouldn't even take out $100,000. What I would do is I would, if necessary. And by the way, I wouldn't do it if cash flow is good. I would do this as a, let's call it a last resort if it is needed. So rather than taking out $100,000 trying to invest it or trying to do something with it, is I would say, well, I know that I have $300,000 of equity in a house, and if necessary, let's say that I need another $10,000 or another $20,000 per year, and maybe I won't need that for 5 years or 10 years, or I hope to plan so that I would never need it. But knowing that that equity is there in the back of my mind, I can then afford to spend a little bit more than if I had zero equity in the home.
Right.
So I would take it out.
Logic.
Okay, I would take it out in smaller chunks as needed.
I can see the logic, but my theory is that it
bothers your spidey senses.
Well, it does, because you know why? Because my theory is you can't retire on plastic, and mm-hmm. this is a way of doing that. You know, it's basically using your house as a credit card. One more thing: I see a lot of people who are approaching retirement and in retirement, as I'm sure you do as well. And one of the things that I find is that the people who are really successful at retirement, meaning people who are happy and financially secure, tend to be the ones who are aware of how much they're spending. And it doesn't mean that they're necessarily watching every dime or that they're living with a budget, but they're just aware of the cash flow. So one of the things that, and I'll just give you a really quick example. If I walk into the grocery store with a credit card, I'm really not paying attention to what... I don't add up everything when I'm running in to buy something at the grocery store. But if I have a $20 bill in my hand and I left the credit card at my office, I add up everything. And in retirement, that attitude of knowing where it's coming from, where the money's coming from and what I'm spending, really helps people achieve a sense of security. And I've seen it time and again. I've seen that, you know, people with tens of millions of dollars, if they don't have a handle on the cash flows, they may not have enough to live on. Whereas somebody with a tiny amount, if they're, again, aware of their cash flow. And it comes down to this. It comes down to looking at what the pension income is, what the Social Security income is, and then looking at the essential expenses and seeing if there's a match. And if there is a match, if the pension income and Social Security income cover the basic expenses, then you can monitor the discretionary expenses and come up with some number now, come up with some number from the portfolio that makes sense, you know, to maintain that lifestyle.
Well, I think I have a lot of clients that would like you, because what I sometimes see is probably the opposite, and maybe it's just the type of people who are attracted to the kind of information that I provide, and that is, and most of my clients are not the $10 and $20 million types. They're the, let's call it $500,000 to $2 million or maybe $3 million types, and they are, let's say, and I would even think a lot of the KQV listeners are the kind of people who worked very hard, got married young when they didn't have a lot of money, worked for 25, 30, 35 years, put money in their retirement plan, paid, but it was hard to save money. They were paying for the kids' braces and then later on for their college and their car payments and the mortgage payments. And now, after, you know, retirement, now they have a significant amount of assets and retirement income. And I find a lot of people in that situation actually being very thrifty, and maybe even your conservative safe withdrawal rate numbers spending actually far less than they could afford.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you run into that.
I actually do run into that as well. I do run into people who are spending less than they could spend. And I don't want to give the impression that we structure portfolios to withdraw only 1 or 2%, or you know, we structure portfolios based on what the demands of the portfolio are. So what are the income demands, and then we structure in such a way to create those demands. But of course, the numbers have to work correctly. But see, as I said before, you know, you as a professional, I as a professional, we can structure a portfolio that can take on more risk than the average person can do. And the reason for that is that we have a mechanism to deal with anything in the portfolio that's not working properly, whereas the individual investor left to his own devices doesn't have that mechanism. They just don't have the software. They don't have the data. They don't have the, many times they don't have the research to back up why something should be sold. So you can structure a portfolio to create more income than the, and I say income, you know, it can be total return or can be income. So that the lifestyle needs are met, but again, it takes someone with that experience to be able to deliver that.
And earlier you made the point, one of the problems with being a complete do-it-yourselfer is that we are emotional animals, and when the market is, you know, very volatile, including times like right now, we feel very nervous, and we tend to get out of the market and in effect sell low. And then when the market does well, we start to feel really good and we buy into it, which in effect is buying high. So we're selling low and buying high, which is the worst combination. And sometimes the discipline of a financial professional can save us from that.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, as you had mentioned, even people, let's say, investing in Vanguard or a particular mutual fund does worse than the index or the mutual fund because of the emotional buying decisions. Well, I'm still trying to pick up some additional income for our retirees, and I know one of the areas that you like to talk about is Social Security. So I was wondering if you could tell some of our listeners some of the strategies that you like for people who are approaching retirement or retired, and what they should be thinking about and when they should be thinking about Social Security, and perhaps maybe the different cases of if they are single and if they are married.
Okay, now Social Security, I have to say, is something that it's not as easy as it looks, and I hate to say this, but the individuals really have to call up the Social Security Department and look at a couple different scenarios. So if they want to retire at the age of 62 or 65 or put it off later, what they can do is they can do a break-even analysis, and there is a tool on the Social Security website that allows you to do that. So you can actually model out when would be a good time to take Social Security. And the theory is the longer you wait, the higher the payment. And there is all these numbers are run based on actuarial assumptions, so they turn out to be, if you live long and you started at 62, you will get more Social Security benefits than if you waited and lived a short life. Now, I suppose the other thing to point out is that if somebody is divorced and has been married for more than 10 years and not remarried, people tend to forget that there may be a benefit for a divorced person that they could look up. But Social Security, surprisingly, is not as simple as it should be. And there I really caution people to just go take their Social Security number to the Social Security office and get it for particular situations.
All right, Julie and Jim, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. I want to remind our listeners, though, out there that we are live tonight. So if you have any thoughts and you want to chime in, you can give us a call at 412-333-9385. We'll be right back in a minute with Julie Jason, Jim Lang on the Lang Money Hour.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Hello there, and welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. This is Nevin Harris, and I'm here with Jim Lang and Julie Jason, author of the AARP Survival Guide.
And Julie, I would agree with you that the number of years you expect to live is an important variable when deciding when to take Social Security. The only thing, and I do want to get to the issue of if you are married, but there's one other thing that I'd be interested in your opinion on, and this actually is not an original idea. This came from Larry Kotlikoff. Larry Kotlikoff is an economist at the University of Boston, and we were talking about this same type of idea, that is, if you take it early and you live a long time, and let's say the break-even number of years is something like 82 or 83, and you live till 95, you would have been much better off if you had waited until age 70, but if you die early, you would have been better off taking the money early and enjoying the use of the money. And I was having a similar conversation with Larry Kotlikoff, and Larry, this is right live on the radio, and he didn't even say Jim, he said, "Lang, quit thinking like an actuary." And I said, "Oh, sorry. He said, "The idea is you don't want your clients to ever run out of money or be uncomfortable when they're old. You're better off waiting because that guarantees you the future income. If you die early, you're dead. Doesn't matter." So there are different ways of looking at this.
I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. But I will tell you that I have found in practice that is a fairly tough sell.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody has been expecting to take Social Security, and even if they weren't going to take it early, if they were expecting to take it at 66, and they come in and I say, "Hey, look, you know, you look great, you don't have cancer, you don't have health, your weight's appropriate, your parents lived until well into their 90s, if you do, you're likely to end up much better off by waiting," and that's a little bit of a tough sell. They usually want to take it earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that as well. And again, it comes back down to cash flows. If the money's there, if other money is there, enough to support people in their lifestyle needs, then delaying Social Security is really the best course of action.
Yeah, and I sometimes split the baby a little bit. I'm a little bit reluctant for people who have nothing but IRA money to have to withdraw IRA money, pay income taxes on it, while they are deferring their Social Security.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So,
depends on where the money's coming from.
Yeah, so I'm going to try to split the baby a little bit. All right, the other thing that Larry talked about, and I don't know if you use different strategies. And let's forget for the moment for the divorce strategies that you had pointed out before. Let's assume that you have a married couple, both, let's say, at Social Security age, maybe it's 66. Do you have do you have advice, and I guess it could be, and you can do either working or not working, do you have advice as to when you would take Social Security and if there is anything special that people in that situation, and here what I'm doing is I'm distinguishing between single and married people.
Actually, I don't. How about you?
All right.
What would you do in that situation?
Well, what I like to do, and this is actually a little trick, and this would be an interesting one for you, is what I like to do, and I've actually looked at some numbers on this, and this is the numbers work out very, very well, and sometimes the difference over a lifetime could be $50,000 or more, and let's assume that you have one who is typically financially stronger than the other. In the old days, that usually was the man. That situation is certainly changing, but let's just to keep things simple, let's assume that the independent or the one who has the greater earnings power, what we have found is a very good strategy is to apply for Social Security and then suspend collection. And you think, well, gee, what good did that do? You applied for it, and then you said, I don't want to get the money. Then what you would do is you would have the spouse apply for Social Security based on the husband's benefit. Now, they will get half the benefit. So in that situation, what you would have is you would have, let's say, the husband applying and suspending, so nothing is coming in the husband's name. The wife would then make an application based on the husband's earnings, would get, let's say, roughly half of what the husband would get. Then that pattern would continue. And what's very interesting is even though the wife is collecting based on the husband, it is not held against the husband when the husband starts collecting on his own at age 70. Mm-hmm. So every year the husband's getting an 8% bump in terms of what the monthly benefit is going to be, despite the fact that the wife is actually collecting on his amount. Then when the wife turns 70, what happens is then in the meantime, she hasn't collected anything on her own account, so her own account is continuing to build. And in that scenario, particularly if one or both of them are long-lived, you can end up getting a lot more money out of Social Security. And that's a kind of a little-known little wrinkle to Social Security.
Very interesting.
Where the idea is you apply and suspend. And it was very interesting. By the way, a quick side story with Larry Kotlikoff. So Larry actually went through that analysis on this show, and I thought it was really good. And when I was writing a book about Roth IRA conversions, I wanted to put that in because there's the other advantage of holding up on your Social Security is that your income is lower, that is more advantageous for Roth IRA conversions. And one of the problems that you have to be careful of with Roth IRA conversions is that you make a conversion that will bump people's income up that will result in increasing the tax on Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
So Larry's strategy of holding up on the Social Security fit in very nicely with my strategy of doing a Roth IRA conversion early. But I wanted to make sure that I had Larry's strategy right. So I got out a transcript of the show and I, you know, tried to nail it. But to make sure that I had it right, I actually emailed the chapter to Larry to make sure that it was right. And what he did is he got back to me and he made about two paragraphs worth of an additional thought that was excellent. And my mom, who's actually 94 years old, and she still edits my book, and believe me, my book had plenty of red ink after my mom was done with it. But for the two sections that Larry wrote, he not only didn't have any red ink on it, but at the end she put, "Very good!" So that's an interesting Social Security. But earlier you had mentioned that if you have a Social Security and a pension that covers at least a large portion of your base expenses, whether they be the property taxes or if you're still renting and the food and things like that, that gives you a little bit more leeway on your portfolio. And I agreed with that.
Yeah, it's all cash flow.
Yeah, and the other thing that you write about and that you talk about, and I think is an important thing for our listeners, is you talk about different standards of care between different advisors, and you have a very good section on your book on how to pick an advisor, and you talk about fiduciary duty and the different fiduciary duties of different types of advisors, and I think that might be a good area for our clients to or our listeners to hear about. So if you could talk a little bit about the fiduciary duty and duty of care and how to pick an advisor.
This is an interesting area because there have been a number of surveys done by the regulators of what the individual investor perceives to be the way of the world when it comes to engaging a financial advisor. And the perception is that every financial advisor, no matter what kind of financial advisor it happens to be, is held to a fiduciary duty. So the public thinks that every financial advisor is no different from every other financial advisor in terms of duty. So there's an educational process that needs to go on to explain to the public that there are different kinds of financial advisors, and it all has to do with regulation. So there's a lack of awareness that different advisors are regulated under different sets of laws. So that's the starting point. Now, I recently saw something that was put together by a consulting firm teaching financial advisors how to present themselves as fiduciaries. So these were fiduciary advisors. And what was interesting about that was that it was presented incorrectly. So here's a consulting firm that's teaching financial advisors how to tell their clients what they do as fiduciaries, and what they said is that you must take a holistic view when you approach your clients, and then you're acting as a fiduciary. Well, that has nothing to do with fiduciary. So, what is a fiduciary is very simple. It's if you have a conflict of interest between yourself and your client, a fiduciary is required to put that in writing and to address that conflict of interest and to act in the favor of the client. So a very simple example is a hidden fee. There are many financial products that have hidden fees built into them. And it's not something that is, it's a standard in the industry that certain products are sold and a commission is paid to the financial advisor, but that fee is paid to the advisor is not clear, and it's not known, and it's not typically not known to the consumer unless they ask for it. So the fiduciary must disclose that fee to you. The non-fiduciary does not have that disclosure requirement. So a product with a hidden fee is not illegal for a non-fiduciary advisor, whereas it is illegal for a fiduciary advisor.
Yeah, and by the way, I just realized that I have missed something that is very important. I did not give people a strong enough plug for your book. I think we mentioned it at the beginning, but I do want to do that. Julie's book is the AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad. Again, that's the AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions of Good Times and Bad. Actually, Julie's written 5 books, but that is the, at least the one that I like the most, or that I liked. And Julie, are they better off getting that on Amazon, or should they go to your website for if they are interested?
Either way, Amazon has the book, and my website is really easy to remember. It's just juliejason.com, and Jason spelled like the guy's name, Jason.
Okay, so again, that's the AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad, by Julie Jason, and you can find that at either amazon.com or at juliejason.com.
All right, Julie and Jim, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We'll be right back in a minute with Julie and Jason, Jim Lang on the Lang Money Hour.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Hello there, and welcome back to the Lang Money Hour. This is Nevin Harris, and I'm here with Jim Lang and Julie Jason, author of the AAP Survival Guide.
Julie, we were talking about different standards of care, and you used the example that if somebody was perhaps selling a product that had some type of commission, that had to be disclosed. And by the way, I'm a fee-only advisor, so I am not a product guy. But I would say also that there are other conflicts that people might not know about, and that is even forgetting the issue of how an advisor is compensated, there might be a difference in what is best for the client. In other words, as a CPA and an attorney and a registered investment advisor, the regulations make it very clear that I am required to make recommendations that I think are in the best interest of the client, not in my own best interest. And I know that is the same with you, both in terms of a regulatory as well as a moral point standpoint. But I don't know if everybody appreciates that is not the same standard for everybody.
Yeah, and this goes back to the survey data. The survey data tells us that the public is unaware that is the case. And you know, people ask me, what they say to me is that, well, isn't that a terrible thing? And the truth is that regulation exacts accountability, and the consumer needs to be aware of the regulation. So people who are held to a fiduciary standard must put the interest of the client first. That typically shows up, Jim, don't you think, in terms of fees and commissions, because that's the first thing that is, how do you put somebody else's interest ahead of yours? Well, first of all, you don't sell something, or you don't take an action that can be harmful to the client and beneficial to you, and that many times is a fee-based decision.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. I know also, and I don't want to mention any names, but I know that there are certain financial institutions that might have a reason to sell a particular product or a particular security, and either through direct commissions or other methods of encouraging their sales force will try to, in effect, encourage people to buy a
right.
particular product.
When
it might not be in the client's best interest, where you and I would have both the legal and the moral, and let's say more importantly here, the legal responsibility, and we are regulated so that the advice that we give must be in the best interest of our clients.
Right. If you think of physicians, for example, a physician may also be selling eyeglasses to make it more convenient for his patients. But then again, it's in the ophthalmologist's interest to sell eyeglasses. So you have these conflicts everywhere. It's not just so it's just a question of being able to identify the conflicts and be able to understand what your role is as a client. So for a non-fiduciary relationship, the client must ask, what are you getting paid if I buy this product? What other products have you considered? And why do you think this product is the best one for me? Or it doesn't have to be a product or a course of action or investment recommendation. But it's quite interesting to see that there are big differences. And as one is approaching retirement in particular, it is extremely important to understand what is your role as a client and what is the advisor's role, and to probe if there is no disclosure document given to you that sets out what the duty is of the advisor. It's your responsibility to ask for that. And that's a way to find out if you're working with a fiduciary or not.
Well, I think that's very good advice. Although personally, I would kind of go along with, I believe his name is Blaine Atkins, who was very interested in changing the regulations. And what he wants is he wants all advisors, whether they be insurance salesmen or stockbrokers or registered investment advisors, to all have the same duty of care, which would be a full fiduciary. And frankly, I would like to see that because it then means that people are going to get better representation.
Well, and again, it depends on disclosure. It all turns on disclosure. What is given to you in writing that tells you what the deal is? You know, how am I getting paid? How is the advisor getting paid? How is the advisor making decisions? And what are the conflicts in writing? That's the fiduciary that has, under the law right now, has to provide you with that kind of disclosure. And if you are working with an insurance agent, for example, who could also sell you products that are retirement income products, for example, there is no such requirement. And I know that there might be good options there, good solutions offered to individuals, but there, because of the non-fiduciary relationship, it's up to them to ask those questions.
Well, and frankly, and this might sound a little bit self-serving, but personally, I think it would be better to just go to somebody who does have a fiduciary obligation rather than to make somebody who doesn't disclose that they don't and then try to be very leery about what their recommendations is. In other words, I would rather go to somebody who I know is acting in my best interest and has to act in my best interest rather than somebody who says, hey, I'm not required to act in your best interest, and here's what my recommendation is. Anyway, the book is the AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad. Again, AARP Retirement Survival Guide, How to Make Smart Financial Decisions in Good Times and Bad, by Julie Jason, Joson, at Amazon.com or at JulieJason.com. This is Jim Lang. You've been listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Check out the show archives and listen on demand anytime at RetireSecure.com. KQV listeners can receive free tickets to Jim Lang's Pittsburgh area workshops and more. Call the Lang Financial Group at 412-521-2732. That's 412-521-2732. And reserve your seats and meet Jim Lang in person. Again, that's 412-521-2732. The Lang Money Hour's executive producer is Nicole DiMartino with the Lang Financial Group on KQV 1410 Pittsburgh.